Coming up on this week's episode of Check Your Balances, we welcome the head of the Motley Fool's Rule Your Retirement Service, Robert Brokamp, to the show. Stick around. That's coming up next.
Check Your Balances is a show produced and owned by Kraftwerk Capital. The views expressed by the hosts and their guests are personal opinions and should not be considered personal financial advice or the opinion of Kraftwerk Capital. All investments have risk and may lose money. Consult with your financial advisor, tax preparer, or attorney prior to implementing anything discussed, and please do not use this show as the sole basis for financial decisions.
Welcome back to another week of Check Your Balances. I am Ross Anderson, joined as always by my friend and co-host Dan Maseka. And this week, we have a special guest on the show joining us, the head of the Rule Your Retirement Service at the Motley Fool, certified financial planner, Robert Brokamp. Bro, great to see you.
So good to see you too. Thanks for having me on the show. So everyone knows my nickname is Bro. So when Dan and Ross refer to me as Bro, that's what they're saying.
It's with love.
Exactly.
Oh my goodness. We were really excited to have you. And you are really the start of my story and probably why anybody is listening to this, because you hired me at the Motley Fool. So anybody has you to blame or thank for that, whichever way you want to look at it.
Yes, it was one of my lasting achievements that didn't last long enough because you're no longer at the Motley Fool. But yes, very happy to have brought you at the Motley Fool and to call you a friend as well. And then, of course, I moved out of Motley Fool Wealth Management by the time Dan came along, but I also feel very strongly that Dan is a solid dude.
I appreciate that. Always good to hear from you, bro, and we are definitely happy to have you here. And we have something in common in our background today. I see a guitar in your corner, so we'll need to get some jamming going on one day as well.
Except you guys are actually talented. I've seen you both perform. You can do it. I'm the guy who's here in my basement playing my guitar, and I have a piano over here, and I'm going to perform at my first recital ever. This Saturday, it's going to be me and a bunch of kids at a church playing the one song that I know on the piano.
That's fantastic. You got to start somewhere.
It's true. It's true.
I have a piano that I cannot play at all. I was hoping that having it here would inspire me to do something with it, but it has not. I just click the buttons that make funny sounds and call that good enough.
So same with me. I had the piano. You got to take lessons. That's the only, for me, the only reason I practice is because I know every week I have to face Daphne with the song I was supposed to learn, and I don't want to go in unprepared. So take lessons. That's the solution.
I actually think that there is something to be said for like booking a gig. So one of the shows that Dan and I played together with this band that basically existed for two nights, Dan called them and booked us a gig. And then we had to learn the music. Like, we hadn't practiced once. We hadn't learned a single thing. And then we had to fill up a three-hour set. And we learned, like, 36 songs and a few practices with me playing drums, him on guitar, and then a couple other friends that joined us. So that pressure of, like, I have to do this in front of people, I actually do think is a fairly viable motivator.
Yeah, everyone needs a good accountability mechanism. And certainly getting on stage in front of a bunch of people will probably work.
What a beautiful transition to financial planning, talking about accountability in your personal financial life. Having that conversation with a financial planner puts it front and center and shows you where you are, and you get instant feedback from a professional to see if you're on track or not. Today, we got a question from a listener about doing it yourself a little bit. So clearly working with a certified financial planner is great, but there are some things you can do on your own to test whether you're on the right track or not. And the internet has made that a lot easier through the availability of calculators. Ross, do you have that question pulled up? Do you want to read it?
Yeah, I do. And this came from Bill, and Bill's been a listener of ours. He even said in his email that he was drinking his morning coffee from our Check Your Balances mug, which we still have a handful of. So if folks have questions for us, they can send them in, and we are happy to send a mug the other way. But he basically said, as he's looking at his 401k and his planning, he'd like to hear our opinion on the best retirement calculators out there. Now, the reason I wanted to reach out to Bro on this is because while we use retirement calculators every day, we use one that is geared towards professionals and is probably not cost effective for a home user to just plug in and start ripping on. We use one called Money Guide Pro. But Bro, you've done some research on this, on what's out there for a consumer to kind of plug their stuff into, and just really wanted to hear your feedback on where Bill should be looking.
Yeah, so I think actually part of this comes down to the history of the Motley Fool, right? Back in the 90s, Tom and David Gardner formed the company on the belief that you can do a lot of investing on your own. You know, you don't need Wall Street to do a lot of the things that you can do in your portfolio and charge high expenses or big commissions. And that led to talking about other parts of your finances and how much can you do in terms of your college savings or your retirement savings on your own. And fortunately, the internet does provide a lot of tools for just running your own numbers. And I do think it's important because in the end, a lot of this is a math problem. Are you saving enough to be able to stop working when you want, when you combine your portfolio with your Social Security, with the tax status of your accounts and inflation and all that things? You kind of need a tool to do that. So fortunately, the internet is full of these tools. Unfortunately, most of them stink. And there have been some studies that have looked at this and determined that they're either overly optimistic. One study in 2018 found that about 70% of the tools that they looked at basically said someone was fine when they really weren't, which means if someone used that tool, they think, oh, I'm good. I don't need to save anymore. I can stop working. And then they'd find out later as they started running out of money that they probably shouldn't have retired. But other tools have basically just provided wide ranges of results. So another study put in one couple's particulars in 12 retirement calculators online to estimate just how much income they'd receive each month in retirement. And the range was anywhere from $3,700 a month to over $6,000 a month with the same criteria. So I do think it's important to run your numbers. Unfortunately, you have to find a really good tool that has lots of ways to customize the inputs so it really does reflect your actual situation.
As you say that, the thing that my mind goes to, and this is very true in our practice, if you're not feeding the calculator accurate assumptions, it doesn't matter how good the math is. And so for anybody that's listening to this going, okay, I'm going to test a few of these and plug some numbers in. If you haven't figured out what you spend, then it doesn't matter if the calculator tells you that you can spend your wrong number for the rest of your life. Yeah. And so that is the one thing that I kind of hammer home. And we do this professionally, and you may not know that we're doing it, but we gut check people's numbers frequently. They'll say, okay, well, this is kind of what I think I live on. And we'll compare that against their income and basically see if that bucket holds any water. Because people will sometimes be earning very high incomes and then project a very modest spending number in retirement, and it just isn't likely. And so having a good estimate there, I still think is the number one thing. Because if you give it crap data, you're not going to get a result that's meaningful for you.
Yeah, and there's so many things that change about when you retire that people don't think about. And the number one, of course, is healthcare. You know, a lot of people go into retirement or right before retirement, they have an outstanding health insurance plan with their employer, and they don't really think about how things are going to change once they stop working, especially if they're retiring before age 65 and eligible for Medicare. But even if you're on Medicare, for 70% of the population, your expenses will go up. So if you based your retirement budget on your current expenditures in healthcare, you're going to be wrong when you retire.
Is there one particular area in most calculators, or even if someone were building something in an Excel spreadsheet for themselves, where you feel people oversimplify or just miss the mark in their forecasting?
So I don't have any proof of this, but the one thing that I think is the most interesting when it comes to not only retirement calculators, but studies of withdrawal rates in retirement, is that the assumption is that you have a certain amount of expenses in your first year of retirement, and that goes up every year for inflation throughout retirement. Studies indicate that's actually not true. For the majority of retirees, expenses are flat to either declining, and that is because as we get older, we just spend less money. We don't go out as much. We don't travel as much. We don't replace our car as much. Sadly, it's often because, you know, you enter retirement as a married couple, but one spouse passes away and then expenses drop 20 to 30%. But then there's healthcare, right? So that's the one situation where you could actually see your expenses go higher. David Blanchett, a researcher, used to be with Morningstar, who's now with Prudential, calls it the retirement spending smile, because you enter retirement and expenses kind of go down, but they tip up at the end. And I think you need some pretty complicated software to model that into your plan, as well as anything else that's unique to you. You might enter retirement with a mortgage, but then it gets paid off within 10 years. How does that affect your expenses? Or maybe at some point, 10 years down the road, you want to do something really big. Like when my dad turned 80, he took the entire family on a cruise, which cost tens of thousands of dollars. How do you plan that type of expenditure into your retirement plan? So it's the way you can model spending throughout retirement that I think is very important.
So have you found a calculator out there that is public facing that you particularly like that, you know, maybe isn't perfect for some of this stuff? Because everything you're talking about is what we spend our day doing with clients, is modeling exactly those types of things where the mortgage rolls off, healthcare expenses with a higher inflation rate than other things, right? Like those, that's like the world we live in. Is there a tool that's consumer facing that's doing at least some of that in a competent way?
Yes, there is. I'm somewhat biased in it in that I was able to offer a few suggestions for it. It's offered by a company called CalcXML, and the company provides all the free calculators on the Motley Fool website. And then when we partnered with them in 2015, they allowed me to make a few tweaks to their more robust retirement calculator. So I'm going to read out the URL. This does not make for good podcasting because it's kind of long, but I'm going to read it to y'all anyhow.
We'll stick it in the show notes for people as well. Okay. So yeah, if you don't catch it live, we'll go ahead and post a link. Great.
So it's calcxml.com/calculators/retirement-planning? SKN equals 606. So that's pretty long, but that will take you there. And one of the suggestions that they incorporated was the ability to break up your retirement spending into three time frames. And this goes back to a book from the 90s where I think the guy's last name was Stein. And he came up with the term for retirement, the go-go years, the slow-go years, and the no-go years. Meaning, you know, when you retire, you start doing all the traveling and you buy the RV and all that stuff, but then you gradually slow down. And then maybe the last 5 to 10 to 15 years of retirement, depending on how long you live, you're basically just at home, hanging out at house, you know, watching TV. Maybe you have some higher healthcare costs, but mostly your expenses have really gone down significantly.
You're making this sound like a lot of fun, bro.
I'll tell you what, the go-go years sound like a lot of fun, and being a DC area native,
You could stretch those out. That's the great thing. You could stretch them out as long as you want, because in this tool, you determine the three stages and how long each stage is. So, you know, maybe you're going to spend 30 years in the go-go years and then just, you know, a few in the slow-go or no-go years. But that's what I like about this tool. And I also like about this tool is it lets you determine, like designate your different accounts as either traditional retirement account, Roth account, or taxable, because a lot of online retirement calculators just assume one, or maybe give you two choices, but not all three. It also allows you to factor in maybe part-time work in retirement, as well as it gives you a lot of flexibility with Social Security. And a lot of retirement calculators just default into a number that they're going to calculate for you based on whatever you put in is this year's income. And it takes this year's income and just assumes what your Social Security benefit is going to be. Whereas this tool allows you the tool will calculate it for you if you want, but you can also put in your actual Social Security benefit, which I think everyone should do, and you can get by creating a My Social Security account with the Social Security Administration, but also allows you to ignore Social Security or just adjust it. So for me, for example, as someone who's 52 years old and knows that, you know, the trust funds and Social Security are going to run out in the early 2030s, I only assume I'm going to get 75% of my projected benefit. And this tool allows me to factor that into my plan.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And I mean, those are a lot of the adjustments that we make. The one thing that I haven't had a tool that's particularly good at is some of them will give us an investing adjustment that we can make, kind of a pre-retirement investing plan and then a post-retirement investing plan. And I always want a third or fourth tier in that, because I always believe, and I think that this is counter, and I've said this on the show before, but the amount of risk you can take in your portfolio should be directly related to how much the portfolio is supporting of cash flow. Well, for a lot of people, that's actually really high in the early years of retirement. And if they're delaying Social Security to 70, once that Social Security kicks in, I actually think the portfolio is doing less heavy lifting and in theory doesn't have to be as conservative as it might be in those initial years. And so I'm always like wanting that lever. And I talk about that in the planning work that I do. So I still account for it somewhere, but I can't really model it effectively because I do think that there's an element of you can probably invest a little bit more aggressively once your portfolio is not doing all that heavy lifting. You may choose not to, but that's the one thing that I can't seem to find a good tool to model.
So we've been talking a lot about financial modeling and numbers, but a big part of financial planning is also behavioral. Now, bro, I know you recently earned a graduate certificate in financial therapy, which is very exciting and interesting. How does that differ from the Certified Financial Planner program and some of the things we've been talking about to this point of financial modeling?
I really have come to believe that financial decisions are emotional decisions. And I think the world of finance has been recognizing that for at least the last 20 years, if not a little sooner. We hear more about like behavioral economics these days and things like that. So financial therapy is a relatively new field, and it sprung more from the actual therapist side. So the people who I would consider the pioneers in the industry are psychologists, you know, marriage counselors. And my wife is actually a therapist. And anyone who's worked professionally in any sort of mental health field will tell you that money plays a role in so much of what's going on in people's lives. You know, it's either causing them stress or anxiety, or it's causing marital problems, or because people have depression or anxiety, they relieve that by becoming spendaholics or compulsive gamblers. So the whole financial therapy field is new, but very exciting to me, because I think fundamentally people know what to do with their money. They know they should be saving. They know they should not be overspending. They know they should be investing well, probably not day trading, probably not doing meme stocks. But the problem is most people are still doing something that is at least suboptimal, if not downright destructive. So financial therapy was just fascinating to look at all the different ways that people are basically engaging in some sort of maladaptive financial behaviors and where that comes from. And it's probably not surprising that a lot of the work so far indicates it comes from what happened to us in childhood and stuff our parents told us. That's probably not surprising. A lot of people have financial trauma, or what some people call financial flashpoints, some event that happened in their life that really changed the way they think about money. And for me, that was when I was in high school, my dad's business went under and he had to declare bankruptcy. And, you know, for a little while there, things were really rough. So you think about like what is the source of your beliefs about money? And are they leading to good behaviors or not good behaviors? And if for the not good behaviors, what can you do? What can you do to change the way you think about money so that you become better with it?
So how would someone engage a financial therapist? Is this a field where you can find people and consult with them much like you would any other kind of therapist, whether that be marriage therapist or whatever it be?
Yeah, and there's the Financial Therapy Association. You can go to their website and you put in your zip code and they'll tell you if there's someone in your area. Just like you guys, you know, many people nowadays are doing it remotely. So you don't have to work with someone who's in your neighborhood or in your town, but you do have to work with someone who is licensed in your state. Because it's still a new field, I wouldn't say there's therapists in every state. So it might take some looking into. But certainly, if you are having issues with compulsive spending, gambling, or money is a real problem in your marriage, highly recommend a financial therapist. But you could also look for a financial planner who has, like I have, the graduate certificate in financial therapy. There's actually a designation, a certified financial therapist, relatively new. Because I think even if you see a financial planner who has an understanding of these things, that can be very helpful. Because when it comes to financial issues, there is often a right or at least right-ish answer. And the financial planner can help that. But then if they have an understanding of why people may not be engaging in the best behaviors, if they can have some understanding of the psychology behind that and nudge people toward being better.
I mean, just hearing you say that is really interesting to me, because I've often taken the view that I've kind of stayed out of people's budgets in terms of where is the money going as a practitioner. And the reason that I've done that is I don't want people to feel like I'm judging where they choose to spend their money, right? That's kind of been my baseline assumption is, look, these are your resources. what I'm trying to do is help you make sure that your plan is sustainable. So where the money goes day to day, none of my business. I don't, you know, if you eat out at restaurants 7 nights a week, like fine. You know, I just want to make sure that we're using reasonable assumptions on can we recreate this for you, whether that's in retirement or whatever that next chapter is. But to get to that level where you're inside the psychology of why people are spending money, you're really talking about getting to a much deeper level of kind of helping people cope with some of those issues. I don't know that one's right or wrong at this point, but it's at least making me question some of those core assumptions on how I practice, which is, should I be more involved in this for certain people?
Certainly, if you have a situation where, you know, you meet with somebody and you say, you know, you got to increase your spending and you have to pay off this credit card debt, and you meet with them a year later and they can't do it, there's something going on there. Because again, I think cognitively people know they need to save and that credit card debt is not good. But what is it? Why can't they change their behavior around? And I do think it's important to broaden what financial therapy is, because when you look into it, there's a lot of discussion of what are called money scripts, for example. And it's basically things that you learned in childhood, formed your beliefs about money. And sometimes those scripts are actually conducive to earning money, but it may not be good for you. For example, like money worship or money vigilance. Like you really care about money, but maybe you care about it too much, right? You conflate your self-worth with your net worth. So you work a lot, you build a high net worth, but you neglect your family or your health. So it really does take a holistic look at the role money plays in your life. Obviously, it's important. You got to pay the bills. You got to accomplish goals. You got to build up sort of a financial fortress so your family's okay if something bad happens. But for some people, it becomes the focus of their life to the exclusion of other things, and that's not good either.
And in the meantime, all of this for you, you've done the financial therapy certificate, and now you're getting a master's in financial planning, because as a financial planning expert already, you've decided, I need a little bit more. What are you learning in your master's program? Has anything come up for you there that you've been really excited about? And has any of it been new information? Because I look at some of those programs as well and go, okay, well, you know, what am I going to get out of this? And I'm curious what your experience has been.
Yeah, so, you know, I'm different than you guys, right? So I consider myself a financial planning philosopher because I just write articles and I do podcasts. I don't work with actual individuals. And so I have to keep my articles very broad and the podcast episodes very broad. And it's mostly on the same stuff over and over again. Whereas I feel like, so I have a very deep knowledge of retirement planning, but a lot of the other aspects of financial planning, I'm not so knowledgeable about, especially since I took my CFP exam back in 2007. So for example, you know, I did the advanced estate planning class and relearned a bunch of stuff about trusts that I had forgotten. And for me personally, it's good because it gives me, frankly, article ideas. So that's good. But I also say this, and I think this is an important component of everyone's financial plan. And that is you got to have a plan B, right? I've been at the Motley Fool for 22 years, 23 years. I've seen a lot of ups and downs. During the dot-com crash, we came within an inch of going out of business. I believe in the Motley Fool. I hope we're on solid ground. But I think everyone has to have a plan B in case something happens. And so for me, getting the education is a way to enhance what I call my human capital, so that if I need to move on from the Motley Fool, or if I want to move on to the Motley Fool, I have something else on my resume, as well as just a broader knowledge base, so that will increase the chances that I can find a job beyond this. And I literally have written out my plan B and plan C, and I think it's crucial to a financial plan. What will happen if you lose your job, or your spouse loses his or her job, or a large expense happens? Where are you going to turn if life does not continue the way it's going? So that's the way it is for me.
Writing out your plan B and plan C is definitely next level. I think it's important to know that with every financial plan, when I deliver it, almost the first thing I say is this is going to be wrong from the second it enters your hands. Things never go according to plan, and preparing for the unexpected is critical. And I think even mapping out what path you'll take after that initial shockwave of whatever may come your way is also important. And admittedly, I've never written out a plan B or C, but maybe I'll have to go do that.
It's important, you know, when something happens, like if you lose your job or something like that, right? That's an emotional event. You never want to make immediate decisions in an emotional event. That said, it's helpful to have thought it out beforehand, before you became emotional. So you're like, all right, I have some vague idea what I'm going to do now. I'm going to take a little bit of time before I make a huge decision and then move my family across the country to take the first job that pops up. But it's good to have thought about it beforehand when you were a little bit more rational, so you have a plan ready to go when you're ready to do it. And I'll just say that, related to what I was saying previously, I think human capital is one of the most neglected aspects of financial planning, because our ability to earn a paycheck is really our number one asset, especially when we're younger or middle age. Once we get closer to retirement age, our human capital starts to dwindle to a certain degree. But I think even working part-time in retirement is a huge benefit. But it's not something we really think a whole lot about, right? What's the best way for me to enhance my skills so that I have a diversified way to make income in many economic scenarios?
So last week on the show, we had Nick Majuli on, and his book has a huge section basically on that, that if you want to improve your financial life, focusing on the income side is one of the best ways to do it, that income and savings rate are directly linked, and that most of the folks that can't save enough money, it's simply because they're not making enough to do it, that cutting will only get so far. And so I realize that you're not coming at it quite from that angle, but improving your human capital is, in my view, what that is, right? It's how can you earn income? How can you improve those skills to be more valuable in the marketplace? And I think that resonates.
Yeah, absolutely. And you guys did a good job of interviewing Nick, and I highly recommend the book. And I can't remember exactly what he said, but he said something like, you know, maybe 20% of the population, they're going to always be stuck in low-wage jobs, and I have great sympathy for them. But for the majority of people, with a well-thought-out plan, you can come up with ways to make more money. If not this year, at least put yourself on a plan to do it in 3 to 5 years. And not only does that increase your income and then allows you to save more, but it affects all kinds of things like Social Security. Your Social Security is based on your highest earning 35 years adjusted for wage inflation. So if you find ways to increase your income, you're going to be boosting your Social Security benefit. And then there's the benefits that come with other jobs, right? So, you know, maybe by boosting your human capital, you can join an employer that offers a pension or outstanding health insurance or outstanding life and disability insurance and all the other things, a stock plan, all the other things that come along with working for a great employer. If that's what you want to do, I think it's also important not to focus your whole life on your job and your money. But if you can put all that together, that's a great thing.
Great advice. Let's put a pin in it right there, bro. We really loved having you on the show. Anybody that wants to read your work can find it on the Motley Fool's website. We'll add a link to your Rule Your Retirement service, which you have been putting out great content into the world. Just as a fairly new podcaster, I mean, we've done this for a little over a year. The fact of how long you've been writing your stuff and continue to have it be relevant is really incredible. It's difficult to come up with new show ideas after doing this a year, let alone a very long and successful career of doing it. So kudos to you. We hope to have you back. And thank you very much for joining us
today. It's been such a pleasure and good to see you too.
One more really big thank you to Bro. It's always great to see him. If you've got questions for us, check your balances at outlook.com. Thanks for tuning in this week. We will catch you guys next time.